are. The boy glanced around the room from under his long fringe, hesitating slightly when his gaze landed on my glittery green skirt. I pulled my bag onto my lap in an attempt to hide it, and he looked away. "Hello, dear. I'm Daphne. My husband took his own life. I don't think it was the nagging." The woman's half-laugh seemed to leak pain. She patted her carefully set hair and peered down awkwardly at her knees. "We were happy." "We were." The boy's hands were tucked under his thighs.
"Jake, Mum, 2 years ago. I've been coming here for the past year because my dad can't deal with it and I needed someone to talk to."
"How is your dad this week, Jake?" said Mark.
"Not bad. I mean, he brought a woman home last Friday night, but, like, he didn't sit on the sofa and cry afterwards, so that's something."
"Jake's father is handling his own grief in his own way," Mark said in my direction.
"Shagging," said Jake. "Mostly shagging." "I wish I was younger," said Fred wistfully.
He was wearing a collar and tie, kind of man who considers himself undressed without one.
"I think that would have been a marvellous way to handle Jilly dying."
"My cousin picked up a man at my aunt's funeral," said a woman in the corner who might have been called Leanne. I couldn't remember. She was small and round and had a thick fringe of chocolate-coloured hair.
"Actually, during the funeral?"
"She said they went to a travel lodge after the sandwiches." She shrugged.
"It's the heightened emotions, apparently."
I was in the wrong place. I could see that now. Surreptitiously, I gathered my belongings, wondering whether I should announce my leaving or whether it would be simpler just to run. Then Mark turned to me expectantly. I stared blankly at him. He raised his eyebrows.
"Oh, me!
Actually, I was just leaving. I think I've, I mean, I don't think I'm..." "Oh, everyone wants to leave on their first day, dear."
"I wanted to leave on my second and third, too."
"That's the biscuits. I keep telling Mark we should have better ones."
"Just tell us the bare bones of it, if you like. Don't worry. You're among friends." They were all waiting. I couldn't run. I hunched back into my seat.
Okay. Well, my name's Louisa, and the man I loved died at 35.
There were a few nods of sympathy.
"Too young.
When did this happen, Louisa?"
20 months ago and a week and 2 days.
3 years, 2 weeks and 2 days. Natasha smiled at me from across the room. There was a low murmur of commiseration. Daphne, beside me, reached out a plump, beringed hand and patted my leg. "We've had many discussions in this room about the particular difficulties when someone dies young," said Mark. "How long were you together?"
A little less than 6 months."
A few barely hidden looks of surprise.
"That's quite brief," a voice said.
"I'm sure Louisa's pain is just as valid," said Mark smoothly.
"And how did he pass, Louisa?"
"Pass what?"
"Die," said Fred helpfully.
He took his own life."
"That must have been a great shock." "Not really. I knew he was planning it." There is a peculiar sort of silence, it turns out, when you tell a room full of people who think they know everything there is to know about the death of a loved one that they don't. I took a breath. "He knew he wanted to do it before I met him. I tried to change his mind and I couldn't. So I went along with it because I loved him, and it seemed to make sense at the time. And now it makes a lot less sense, which is why I'm here."
"Death never makes sense," said Daphne.
"Unless you're Buddhist," said Natasha.
"I keep trying to think Buddhist thoughts, but I'm worried that Olaf is going to come back as a mouse or something, and I'm going to poison him," she sighed. "I have to put poison down, and we have a terrible mouse problem in our block."
"Oh, you'll never get rid of them. They're like fleas," said Sunil. "For everyone you see, there are hundreds of them behind the scenes."
"You might want to think about what you're doing, Natasha, love," said Daphne. "There could be hundreds of little Olafs running around. My Alan could be one of them. You could actually be poisoning the both of them."
"Well," said Fred, "if it's Buddhist, he'd just come back as something else, wouldn't he?"
"But what if it's a fly or something and Natasha kills that too?"
"I'd hate to come back as a fly," said William. "Horrible black hairy things."
He shuddered.
I'm not like some mass murderer, said Natasha. You're making it sound like I'm out there slaughtering everyone's reincarnated husbands.
Well, that mouse might be someone's husband, even if it isn't Olaf.
I think we should try to steer this session back on track, said Mark, rubbing his temple. Louisa, it's brave of you to come and tell your story. Why don't you tell us a bit more about how you and, what was his name? How you met? You're in a circle of trust. We've all pledged our stories go no further than these walls.
It was at that point I happened to catch Jake's eye. He glanced at Daphne, then at me, and shook his head subtly.
I met him at work, I said, and his name was Bill. Despite what I had promised Dad, I wasn't planning to attend the Moving On Circle, but my return to work had been so awful that by the time the day ended, I hadn't been able to face going back to an empty flat.
You're back!
Carly had placed the cup of coffee on the bar, taken the businessman's change and hugged me, all while dropping the coins into the correct sections of the till drawer in one fluid motion.
What the hell happened? Tim just told us you had an accident, and then he left, so I wasn't sure that you were coming back.
It's a long story, I said at her. What are you wearing? 9 o'clock on Monday morning in the airport had been a blue-grey blur of men charging laptops, staring into iPhones, reading the city pages or talking discreetly into headsets about market share. Carly caught the eye of someone on the other side of the till.
Yeah, well, things have changed since you've been gone.
I turned to see a businessman standing on the wrong side of the bar. I blinked at him and put my bag down.
If you'd like to wait there, I'll serve you.
You must be Louise.
His handshake was emphatic and without warmth.
I'm the new bar manager at Richard Percival.
I took in his slick hair, his suit, his pale blue shirt and wondered what kind of bars he had actually managed. Nice to meet you.
You're the one who's been off for 2 months.
Well, yes, I... He walked along the optics, scanning each bottle.
I just want you to know that I'm not a fan of people taking endless sick leave.
My neck shifted a few centimetres back in my collar.
I'm just laying down a marker, Louise. I'm not one of those managers who turn a blind eye. I know that in many companies, time off is pretty much considered a staff perk, but not in companies where I work.
Believe me, I've not thought of the last 9 weeks as a perk. He examined the underside of a tap and rubbed at it meditatively with his thumb. I took a breath before I spoke. I fell off a building. Perhaps I could show you my surgery scars. So, you know, you can be reassured that I'm unlikely to want to do it again. He stared at me.
There's no need to be sarcastic. I'm not saying you're about to have other accidents, but your sick leave is pro rata, at an unusually high level for someone who has worked for this company a relatively short time. That's all I wanted to point out, that it has been noted.
He wore cufflinks with racing cars on them.
Message received, Mr. Percival, I said. I'll do my best to avoid further near-fatal accidents.
You'll need a uniform. If you give me 5 minutes, I'll get one out of the stockroom.
What size are you? 12? 14?
I stared at him. 10. He raised an eyebrow. I raised one back. As he walked to his office, Carly leaned over the coffee machine and smiled sweetly in his direction.
Utter, utter bellend, she said from the side of her mouth.
She wasn't wrong. From the moment I returned, Richard Percival was, in the words of my father, all over me like a bad suit. He measured my measures, checked every corner of the bar for molecular peanut crumbs, was in and out of the loos checking on hygiene, and wouldn't let us leave until he had stood over us cashing up and ensuring each till roll matched takings to the last penny. I no longer had time to chat to the customers, to look up departure times, hand over lost passports, contemplate the planes we could see taking off through the great glass window. I didn't even have time to be irritated by Celtic Panpipes Volume 3. If a customer was left waiting to be served for more than 10 seconds, Richard would magically appear from his office, sighing ostentatiously, then apologise loudly and repeatedly because they had been kept waiting so long. Carly and I, usually busy with other customers, would exchange secret glances of resignation and contempt. He spent half the day meeting reps, the rest on the phone to head office, bleating about footfall and spend per head. We were encouraged to upsell with every transaction, and taken to one side for a talking to if we forgot. All that was bad enough, but then there was the uniform. Carly came into the ladies as I was finishing getting changed and stood beside me in front of the mirror.
We look like a pair of eejits, she said. Not content with dark skirts and white shirts, some marketing genius high up the corporate ladder had decided that the atmosphere of the Shamrock and Clover chain would benefit from genuine Irish clothing. This genuine Irish clothing had evidently been thought up by someone who believed that across Dublin, right this minute, businesswomen and checkout girls were pirouetting across their workplaces, dressed in embroidered tabards, knee-high socks and laced-up dancing shoes, all in glittering emerald green, with accompanying ringlet wigs. Jesus! If my boyfriend saw me dressed up like this, he'd dump me. Carly lit a cigarette and climbed up on the sink to disable the smoke alarm on the ceiling. Mind you, he'd probably want to do me first. The perv. What do the men have to wear? I pulled my short skirts out to the sides and eyed Carly's lighter nervously, wondering how flammable I was. Look outside. There's only Richard, and he has to wear that shirt with a green logo. Oh, the poor thing. That's it? What, no pixie shoes or little leprechaun hat? Surprise, surprise! It's only us girls who have to work looking like porno munchkins. I look like Dolly Parton the early years in this wig. Grab a red one. Lucky us, we have a choice of three colours. From somewhere outside, we could hear Richard calling. My stomach had begun to clench reflexively whenever I heard his voice. Anyway, I'm not staying. I'm going to Riverdance my way out of this place and into another job, Carly said. He can stick his bloody shamrocks up his tight little corporate arse. She had given what I could only describe as a sarcastic skip and left the ladies. I spent the rest of the day getting little electric shocks from the static. The moving on circle ended at 9:30. I walked out into the humid summer evening, exhausted by the twin trials of work and the evening's events. I took off my jacket too hot, feeling suddenly that, having laid myself bare in front of a room full of strangers, being seen in a faux Irish dancer uniform, which was in truth ever so slightly too small, didn't really make much difference. I hadn't been able to talk about Will. Not the way they had talked, as if their loved ones were still part of their lives, perhaps in the next room. Oh yes, my Jilly used to do that all the time. I can't delete my brother's voicemail message. I have a little listen to his voice when I feel like I'm going to forget what he sounded like. Sometimes I can hear him in the next room. I could barely even say Will's name. And listening to their tales of family relationships, of 30-year marriages, shared houses, lives, children, I felt like a fraud. I had been a carer for someone for 6 months. I'd loved him and watched him end his life. How could these strangers possibly understand what Will and I had been to each other during that time? How could I explain the way we had so swiftly understood each other? The shorthand jokes, the blunt truths and raw secrets. How could I convey the way those short months had changed the way I felt about everything? The way he had skewed my world so totally that it made no sense without him in it. And when it came down to it, what was the point in re-examining your sadness all the time anyway? It was like picking at a wound and refusing to let it heal. I knew what I had been part of. I knew what my role was. What was the point in going over and over it? I wouldn't come next week. I knew now. I would find an excuse for Dad. I walked slowly across the car park, rummaging in my bag for my keys, telling myself that it at least meant that I hadn't had to spend another evening alone in front of my television, dreading the passing of the 12 hours until I had to return to work. His name wasn't really Bill, right? Jake fell into step alongside me. Nope. Daphne's like a one-woman broadcasting corporation. She means well, but your personal story will be all over her social club before you can say rodent reincarnation. Thanks for that. He grinned at me and nodded towards my Lurex skirt. Nice threads, by the way. It's a good look for a grief counselling session. He stopped briefly to retie a shoelace. I stopped with him. I hesitated, then said, I'm sorry about you, Mum. His face was sombre. You can't say that. It's like prison. You can't ask someone what they're in for. Really? I'm sorry, I didn't... I'm joking. I'll see you next week. A man leaning against a motorbike lifted a hand in greeting. He stepped forward as Jake crossed the car park and enveloped him in a bear hug, kissing his cheek. I stopped to watch, mostly because it was rare to see a man hug his son like that in public, once they were over satchel-carrying age. How was it? Okay, the usual, Jake gestured to me. Oh, this is Louisa. She's new. The man squinted at me. He was tall and broad-shouldered. A nose that might once have been broken gave him the faintly bruising appearance of a former boxer. I nodded a polite greeting. It was nice to meet you, Jake. Bye then. I lifted a hand and began to make my way to my car. But as I passed the man, he kept staring at me, and I felt myself colour under the intensity of his gaze. You're that girl, he said. Oh no, I thought, slowing suddenly. Not here too. I stared at the ground for a moment and took a breath. Then I turned back to face them both. Okay. As I've just made clear in the group, my friend made his own decisions. All I ever did was support them. Not that, if I'm honest, I really want to get into this right here, and with a complete stranger. Jake's father continued to squint at me. He lifted his hand to his head. I understand that not everybody will get it, but that's the way it was. I don't feel I have to debate my choices, and I'm really tired, and it's been a bit of a day, and I think I'm going to go home now. He cocked his head to one side, and then he said, I have no idea what you're talking about. I frowned. The limp. I noticed you have a limp. You live near that massive new development, right? You're the girl who fell off the roof. March, April. And suddenly I recognised him. Oh, you were the paramedic. We were the team who picked you up. I'd been wondering what happened to you. I almost buckled with relief. I let my gaze run over his face, his hair, his arms, suddenly recalling with Pavlovian accuracy his reassuring manner, the sound of the siren, the faint scent of lemons, and I let out of breath. I'm good. Well, not good exactly. I have a shot hip and a new boss who's an utter arse and, you know, I'm at grief counselling club in a damp church hall with people who are just really, really sad, said Jake helpfully. The hip will get better. It's plainly not hindering your dance career. My laugh emerged as a honk. Oh no, no this, this is... The outfit is related to the boss who is an arse. It's not my normal mode of dress. Anyway, thank you. Wow. I put my hand to my head. This is weird. You saved me. It's good to see you. We don't often get to see what happens afterwards. You did a great job. I was... Well, you were really kind. I remember that much. Janada. I stared at him. Janada, Spanish. It was nothing. Oh, okay then. I take it all back. Thanks for nothing. He smiled and raised a paddle-sized hand. Afterwards, I didn't know what made me do it. Hey. He looked back towards me. It's Sam, actually. Sam, I didn't jump. Okay. No, really, I mean, I know you've just seen me coming out of a grief counselling group and everything, but it's... Well, I wouldn't jump. He gave me a look that seemed to suggest that he had seen and heard everything. Good to know. We gazed at each other for a minute, then he lifted his hand again. Nice to see you, Louisa. He pulled on a helmet and Jake slid onto the bike behind him. I found myself watching as they pulled out of the car park. And because I was still watching, I caught Jake's exaggerated eye roll as he pulled on his own helmet. And then I remembered what he had said in the session. The compulsive shagger. Idiot, I told myself, and limped across the rest of the tarmac to where my car was boiling gently in the evening heat. Chapter 5. I lived on the edge of the city. In case I was in any doubt, across the road stood a huge office block-sized crater, surrounded by a developer's hoarding, upon which was written, Farthingate, where the city begins. We existed at the exact point where the glossy glass temples to finance butted up against the grubby old brick and sash windows of curry shops and 24-hour grocers, of stripper pubs and minicab offices that resolutely refused to die. My block sat among those architectural refuseniks, a lead-stained warehouse-style building staring at the steady onslaught of glass and steel and wondering how long it could survive, perhaps rescued by a hipster juice bar or pop-up retail experience. I knew nobody except Samir, who ran the convenience store, and the woman in the bagel bakery, who smiled at me in greeting but didn't seem to speak any English. Mostly, this anonymity suited me. I had come here, after all, to escape my history, from feeling as if everyone knew everything there was to know about me, and the city had begun to alter me. I had come to know my little corner of it, its rhythms and its danger points. I learned that if you gave money to the drunk at the bus station, he would come and sit outside your flat for the next 8 weeks. That if I had to walk through the estate at night, it was wise to do it with your keys lodged between your fingers. That if I was walking out to get a late-night bottle of wine, it was probably better not to glance at the group of young men huddled outside Kebab Corner. I was no longer disturbed by the persistent whomp, whomp, whomp of the police helicopter overhead. I could survive. Besides, I knew more than anyone that worse things could happen.
Hey. Hey, Lou. Can't sleep again? It's just gone 10 o'clock here. So, what's up?
Nathan, Will's former physio, had spent the last 9 months working in New York for a middle-aged CEO with a Wall Street reputation, a four-story townhouse, and a muscular condition. Calling him in my sleepless small hours had become something of a habit. It was good to know there was someone who understood, out there in the dark, even if sometimes his news felt tinged with a series of small blows. Everyone else has moved on. Everyone else has achieved something.
So how's the Big Apple? Not bad.
His antipodean drawl made every answer a question. I lay down on the sofa, pushing my feet up on the armrest. Yeah, that doesn't tell me a whole lot.
Okay. Well, got a pay rise, so that was cool. Booked myself a flight home in a couple of weeks to see the olds. So that'll be good. They're over the moon because my sister's having a baby. Oh, and I met a really fit bird in a bar down on 6th Avenue, and we were getting on real well, so I asked her out. And when I told her what I did, she said sorry, but she only went out with guys who wore suits to work.
He laughed. I found I was smiling.
What, so scrubs don't count? Apparently not. Though she did say she might have changed her mind if I was an actual doctor.
He laughed again. Nathan was made of equanimity.
It's cool. Girls like that get all picky if you don't take them to the right restaurants and stuff. Better to know sooner, right? How about you?
I shrugged. Getting there, sort of.
You still sleeping in his T-shirt?
No. It stopped smelling of him. And it had started to get a bit unsavoury, if I'm honest. I washed it and I packed it in tissue. But I've got his jumper for bad days.
Yeah, good to have a backup.
Oh, and I went to the grief counselling group.
How was it?
Crap. I felt like a fraud. Nathan waited. I shifted the pillow under my head. Did I imagine it all, Nathan? Sometimes I think I've made what happened between Will and me so much bigger in my head. Like, how can I have loved someone that much in such a short time? And all these things I think about the two of us, did we actually feel what I remember? The further we get from it, the more those 6 months just seem like this weird dream. There was a tiny pause before Nathan responded. You didn't imagine it, mate. I rubbed my eyes. Am I the only one? Still missing him. Another short silence. Nah, he was a good bloke. The best. That was one of the things I liked about Nathan. He didn't mind a lengthy phone silence. I finally sat up and blew my nose.
Anyway, I don't think I'll go back. I'm not sure it's my thing.
Oh, give it a go, Lou. You can't judge anything from one session.
God, you sound like my dad.
Well, he always was a sensible fella.
I started at the sound of the doorbell. Nobody ever rang my doorbell. Aside from Mrs. Nellis in flat 12 when the postman had accidentally swapped our mail, I doubted she was up at this hour. And I certainly was not in receipt of her Elizabeth Doll Partwork magazine. It rang again. A third time. Shrill and insistent.
Look, I've got to go. Someone's at the door.
Keep your pecker up, mate. You'll be okay.
I put the phone down and stood up warily. I had no friends nearby. I hadn't worked out how you actually made them when you moved to a new area and spent most of your upright hours working.
And if my parents had decided to stage an intervention and bring me back to Stortfold, they would have organised it between rush hours, as neither of them liked driving in the dark.
I waited, wondering if whoever it was would simply realise their mistake and go away. But it rang again, jarring and endless, as if they were now leaning against the bell. I got up and walked to the door.
Who is it?
I need to talk to you.
A girl's voice. I peered through the spy hole. She was looking down at her feet, so I could only make out long chestnut hair, an oversized bomber jacket. She swayed slightly, rubbed at her nose. Drunk?
I think you have the wrong flat.
Are you Louisa Clark?
I paused.
How do you know my name?
I need to talk to you. Can you just open the door?
Well, it's almost 10:30 at night.
Yeah, that's why I'd rather not be standing here in your corridor.
I had lived there long enough to know not to open my door to strangers. In that area of town, it was not unusual to get the odd junkie ringing bells speculatively in the hope of cash. But she was a well-spoken girl. And young. Too young to be one of the journalists who had briefly fixated on the story of the handsome former whiz kid who had decided to end his life. Too young to be out this late. I angled my head, trying to see if there was anyone else in the corridor. It appeared to be empty.
Can you tell me what it's about? Not out here, no.
I opened the door to the length of the safety chain so that we were eye to eye. You're going to have to give me more than that. She couldn't have been more than 16. The dewy plumpness of youth still visible in her cheeks. Her hair long and lustrous. Long, skinny legs and tight black jeans, flicky eyeliner and a pretty face. So, who did you say you were? I asked.
Lily. Lily Horton Miller. Look, she said and lifted her chin an inch. I need to talk to you about my father.
I think you have the wrong person. I don't know anyone called Horton Miller. There must be another Louisa Clark you've confused me with. I made to shut the door, but she had wedged the toe of her shoe in it. I looked down at it and slowly back at her. Not his name, she said, as though I was stupid. And when she spoke, her eyes were both fierce and searching. His name is Will Traynor. Lily Horton Miller stood in the middle of my living room and surveyed me with the detached interest of a scientist gazing at a new variety of manure-based invertebrate.
Wow! What are you wearing?
I work in an Irish pub.
Pole dancing?
Having apparently lost interest in me, she pivoted slowly, gazing at the room.
This is where you actually live. Where's your
furniture? I just moved in.
One sofa, one television, two boxes of books.
She nodded towards the chair on which I sat, my breathing still unbalanced, trying to make any kind of sense of what she had just told me. I stood up. I'm going to get a drink. Would you like something?
I'll have a Coke, unless you've got wine.
How old are you?
Why do you want to know?
What? I don't understand. I went behind the kitchen counter. Will didn't have children. I would have known. I frowned at her, suddenly suspicious.
Is this some kind of joke?
A joke? Will and I talked a lot. He would have told me.
Yeah, well, turns out he didn't. And I need to talk about him to someone who is not going to totally freak out every time I mention his name, like the rest of my family.
She picked up the card from my mother and put it down again.
I'm hardly going to say it as a joke. I mean, yeah, my real dad, some sad bloke in a wheelchair, like, that's funny.
I handed her a glass of water.
But who is your family? I mean, who's your mother? Have you got any cigarettes?
She had started pacing around the room, touching things, picking up the few belongings I had and putting them down. When I shook my head, she said,
My mother is called Tanya, Tanya Miller. She's married to my stepdad, who is called Francis Stupid Fuckface Horton.
Nice name. She put down the water and pulled a packet of cigarettes from her bomber jacket and lit one. I was going to say she couldn't smoke in my home, but I was too taken aback, so I simply walked over to the window and opened it. I couldn't take my eyes off her. I could maybe see little hints of Will. It was in her blue eyes, that vaguely caramel colouring. It was in the way she tilted her chin slightly before she spoke, her unblinking stare. Or was I seeing what I wanted to see? She gazed out of the window at the street below. Lily, before we go on, there's something I need to...
I know he's dead, she said.
She inhaled sharply and blew the smoke into the centre of the room. I mean, that was how I found out. There was some documentary on television about assisted suicide, and they mentioned his name, and Mum totally freaked out for no reason, and ran to the bathroom, and Fuckface went after her, so obviously I listened outside. And she was in total shock because she hadn't even known that he'd ended up in a wheelchair. I heard the whole thing. I mean, it's not like I didn't know that Fuckface wasn't my real dad. It's just that my mum only ever said that my real dad was an arsehole who didn't want to know me.
Will wasn't an arsehole.
She shrugged. He sounded like one.
But anyway, when I tried to ask her questions, she just started totally flipping out and said that I knew everything about him that I needed to know and that Fuckface Francis had been a better dad to me than Will Traynor ever would have been, and I really should leave it alone.
I sipped my water. I'd never wanted a glass of wine more.
So what did you do?
She took another drag of her cigarette.
I Googled him, of course, and I found you.
I needed to be alone to digest what she had told me. It was too overwhelming. I didn't know what to make of the spiky girl who had walked around my living room making the air around her crackle.
So did he not see anything about me at all?
I was staring at her shoes, ballerina pumps heavily scuffed as if they had spent too much time shuffling around London streets. I felt as if I was being reeled in. How old are you, Lily?
16. Do I at least look like him? I saw a picture on Google Images, but I was thinking maybe you had a photograph?
She gazed around the living room.
Are all your photographs in boxes?
She eyed the cardboard crates in the corner, and I wondered whether she would actually open them and start going through them. I was pretty sure the one she was about to go into contained Will's jumper, and I felt a sudden panic.
Lily, this is all quite a lot to take in, and if you are who you say you are, then we do have a lot to discuss. But it's nearly 11 o'clock, and I'm not sure this is the time to start. Where do you live?
St. John's Wood?
Well, your parents are going to be wondering where you are, so why don't I give you my number and we... I can't go home!
She faced the window, flicking the ash out with a practiced finger. I mean, strictly speaking, I'm not even meant to be here. I'm meant to be at school, weekly boarding. I'll be freaking out now because I'm not there.
She pulled out her phone as an afterthought and grimaced at whatever she saw on its screen, then shoved it back in her pocket.
Well, I'm not sure what I can do other than...
Well, I thought maybe I could just stay here, just tonight, and then you could tell me some more stuff about him.
What, stay here?
No, I'm sorry, you can't. I don't know you.
But you did know my dad. Did you say you think he didn't actually know about me?
You need to go home. Look, let's call your parents. They can come and collect you. Let's do that, and I...
She stared at me.
I thought you'd help me.
I will help you, Lily, but this isn't the way to...
You don't believe me, do you?
I have no idea what to...
You don't want to help. You don't want to do anything. What have you actually told me about my dad?
Nothing.
How have you actually helped? You haven't.
Thanks.
Hold on. No, that's not fair. We've only just...
But the girl flicked her cigarette butt out of the window and turned to walk past me out of the room.
What? Where are you going?
Oh, what do you care? She said. And before I could say anything more, the front door had slammed and she was gone. I sat very still on my sofa, trying to digest what had just happened for the best part of an hour. Lily's voice ringing in my ears. Had I heard her correctly? I went over and over what she had told me, trying to recall it through the buzz in my ears. My father was Will Traynor. Lily's mother had apparently told her Will had not wanted anything to do with her. But surely he would have mentioned something to me. We had no secrets from each other. Weren't we the two people who had managed to talk about everything? For a moment I wobbled. Had Will not been as honest with me as I'd believed? Had he actually possessed the ability simply to airbrush an entire daughter out of his conscience? My thoughts were chasing each other in circles. I grabbed my laptop, sat cross-legged on the sofa and typed, Lily Horton Miller, into a search engine. And when that came up with no results, I tried again with various spellings, settling on Lily Houghton Miller, which brought up a number of hockey fixture results posted by a school called Upton Tilton in Shropshire. I called up some of the images and I zoomed in. There she was, an unsmiling girl in a row of smiling hockey players. Lily Horton Miller played a brave if unsuccessful defence. It was dated 2 years ago. Boarding school. She said she was meant to be at boarding school, but it still didn't mean she was any relation of Will's or... Indeed, that her mother had been telling the truth about her parentage. I altered the search to just the words Horton Miller, which brought up a short diary item about Francis and Tanya Horton Miller attending a banking dinner at the Savoy and a planning application from the previous year for a wine cellar under a house in St. John's Wood. I sat back, thinking, then did a search on Tanya Miller and William Traynor. It turned up nothing. I tried again using Will Traynor, and suddenly, I was on a Facebook thread for alumni of Durham University, on which several women, all of whose names seemed to end in Ella, Estella, Fenella, Arabella, were discussing Will's death. I couldn't believe it when I heard it on the news. Him of all people, R.I.P. Will. Nobody gets through life unscathed. You know Rory Appleton died in the Turks and Caicos in a speeding boat accident.
Didn't he do geography? Red hair?
No, PPE. I'm sure I snogged Rory at Fresh's ball, enormous tongue. I'm not being funny, Fenella, but that's rather bad taste. The poor man is dead.
Wasn't Will Traynor the one who went out with Tanya Miller for the whole of the third year?
I don't see how it's in poor taste to mention that I may have kissed someone just because they then went on to pass away.
I'm not saying you have to rewrite history. It's just his wife might be reading this, and she might not want to know that her beloved stuck his tongue in the face of some girl on Facebook.
I'm sure she knows his tongue was enormous. I mean, she married him.
Rory Appleton got married.
Here's the link. Tanya married some banker. I always thought she and Will would get married when they were at uni. Oh, they were so gorgeous.
I clicked on the link, which showed a picture of a reed-thin blonde woman with an artfully tousled chignon, smiling as she stood on the steps of a register office with an older, dark-haired man. A short distance away, at the edge of the picture, a young girl in a white tulle dress was scowling. She bore a definite resemblance to the Lily Horton Miller I had met. But the image was 7 years old, and in truth, it could have betrayed any grumpy young bridesmaid with long, mid-brown hair. I reread the thread and closed my laptop. What should I do? If she really was Will's daughter, should I call the school? I was pretty sure there were rules about strangers who tried to contact teenage girls. And what if this really was some elaborate scam? Will had died a wealthy man. It wasn't beyond the realm of possibility that somebody could think up an intricate scheme by which to leech money from his family. When Dad's mate Chalky died of a heart attack, 17 people had turned up at the wake telling his wife he owed them betting money. I would steer clear, I decided. There was too much potential for pain and disruption if I got this wrong. But when I went to bed, it was Lily's voice I heard, echoing into the silent flat. Will Traynor was my father. Chapter 6.
Sorry, my alarm didn't go off. I rushed past Richard and hung my coat on the peg, pulling my synthetic skirt down over my thighs. 3/4 of an hour late. This is not acceptable.
It was 8:30 a.m. We were, I noted, the only two people in the bar. Carly had left. She hadn't even bothered telling Richard to his face. She simply sent a text message telling him she would drop the sodding uniform in at the end of the week, and that as she was owed 2 weeks sodding holiday pay, she was taking her sodding notice in lieu.
If she had bothered to read the employment handbook, he had fumed, she would have known that taking notice in lieu of holiday was completely unacceptable. It was there in Section 3 as clear as day, if she had cared to look, and the sodding language was simply unnecessary.
He was now going through the due processes to find a replacement, which meant that until due processes were completed, it was just me and Richard. I'm sorry, something came up at home. I had woken with a start at 7:30, unable for several minutes to recall what country I was in or what my name was, and had lain on my bed unable to move while I mulled over the previous evening's events.
A good worker doesn't bring their home life to the workplace with them,
Richard intoned as he pushed past me with his clipboard. I watched him go, wondering if he even had a home life. He never seemed to spend any time there. Yeah, well, a good employer wouldn't make his employee wear a uniform Stringfellows would have rejected as tacky. I muttered, as I tapped my code into the till, pulling the hem of my Lurex skirt down with my free hand. He turned swiftly and walked back across the bar.
What did you say?
Nothing.
Yes, you did.
I said, I'll remember that for next time. Thank you very much for reminding me. I smiled sweetly at him. He looked at me for several seconds longer than was comfortable for either of us, and then he said,
the cleaner is off sick again. You'll need to do the gents before you start on the bar.
His gaze was steady, daring me to say something. I reminded myself that I could not afford to lose this job. I swallowed.
Right. Oh, and cubicle 3 is a bit of a mess.
Jolly good, I said. He turned on his highly polished heel and walked back into the office. I sent mental voodoo arrows into the back of his head the whole way. This week's Moving On Circle is about guilt. Survivor's guilt. Guilt that we didn't do enough. It's often this that keeps us from moving forward. Mark waited as we handed around the biscuit tin, then leaned forward on his plastic chair, his hands clasped in front of him. He ignored the low rumbling of discontent that there were no bourbon creams.
I used to get ever so impatient with Jilly, Fred said into the silence. When she had the dementia, I mean, she would put dirty plates back in the kitchen cupboard and I would find them days later and... I'm ashamed to say I did shout at her a couple of times.
He wiped at an eye.
She was such a house-proud woman before, and that was the worst thing.
You lived with Jilly's dementia for a long time, Fred. You'd have had to have been superhuman not to find it a strain.
Dirty plates would drive me mad, said Daphne. I think I would have shouted something terrible. But it wasn't her fault, was it?
Fred straightened on his chair. I think about those plates a lot. I wish I could go back. I'd wash them up without saying a word, just give her a nice cuddle instead.
I find myself fantasizing about men on the tube, said Natasha. Sometimes when I'm riding up an escalator, I exchange a look with some random man going down, and before I've even got to the platform, I'm building a whole relationship with him in my head. You know, where he runs back down the escalator because he just knows there's something magical between us, and we stand there gazing at each other amid the crowds of commuters on the Piccadilly line, and then we go for a drink, and before you know it, we're...
Sounds like a Richard Curtis movie, said William.
I like Richard Curtis movies, said Sunil, especially that one about the actress and the man in his pants.
Shepherd's Bush, said Daphne. There was a short pause.
I think it's Notting Hill, Daphne, Mark said.
I prefer Daphne's version.
What? Said William, snorting. We're not allowed to laugh now.
So in my head we're getting married, said Natasha. And then we're standing at the altar. I think, what am I doing? Olaf only died 3 years ago and I'm fantasizing about other men.
Mark leaned back in his chair. You don't think that's natural after 3 years by yourself, to fantasize about other relationships?
But if I had really loved Olaf, surely I wouldn't think about anyone else.
It's not the Victorian age, said William. You don't have to wear widow's weeds till you're elderly.
If it was me that died, I'd hate the thought of Olaf falling in love with someone else.
Well, you wouldn't know, said William. You'd be dead.
What about you, Louisa? Mark had noticed my silence. Do you suffer feelings of guilt?
Can we do someone else?
I'm Catholic, said Daphne. I feel guilty about everything. It's the nuns, you know.
What do you find difficult about this subject, Louisa?
I took a swig of coffee. I felt everyone's eyes on me.
Come on, I told myself. I swallowed.
That I couldn't stop him, I said.
Sometimes I think if I had been smarter or handled things differently or just been more... I don't know, more anything.
You feel guilty about Bill's death because you feel you could have stopped him.
I pulled at a thread. When it came away in my hand, it seemed to loosen something in my brain. Also that I'm living a life that is so much less than the one I'd promised him I'd live. And guilt over the fact that he basically paid for my flat when my sister will probably never be able to afford one of her own. And guilt that I don't even really like living in it because it doesn't feel like mine and it feels wrong to make it nice because all I associate it with is the fact that Bill is dead and somehow I benefited from that.
There was a short silence. You shouldn't feel guilty about property, said Daphne.
I wish someone would leave me a flat, said Sunil.
But that's just a fairy tale ending, isn't it?
Man dies, everyone learns something, moves on, creates something wonderful out of his death.
I was speaking without thinking now. I've done none of those things. I've basically just failed at all of it.
My dad cries nearly every time he shags someone who isn't my mum, Jake blurted, twisting his hands together.
He stared out from under his fringe.
He charms women into sleeping with him and then he gets off on being sad about it. It's like as long as he feels guilty about it, afterwards it's okay.
You think he uses his guilt as a crutch?
I just think either you have sex or feel glad that you're having all the sex.
I wouldn't feel guilty about having all the sex, said Fred.
Well, you treat women like human beings and you make sure you don't have anything to feel guilty about. Or don't even sleep with anyone and treasure Mum's memory until you're actually ready to move on.
His voice broke on Treasure and his jaw tautened. We were used by then to the sudden stiffening of expressions and an unspoken group courtesy meant that we each looked away until any potential tears subsided. Mark's voice was gentle.
Have you told your father how you feel, Jake?
We don't talk about Mum. He's fine as long as, you know, we don't actually mention her.
That's quite a burden for you to carry alone.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm here, isn't it?
There was a short silence.
Have a biscuit, Jake, darling, said Daphne. And we passed the tin back round the circle, vaguely reassured in some way. Nobody could quite define when Jake finally took one.
I kept thinking about Lily. I barely registered Sunil's tale of weeping in the baked goods section of the supermarket and just about raised a sympathetic expression for Fred's solitary marking of Jilly's birthday with a bunch of foil balloons. For days now, the whole episode with Lily had taken on the tenor of a dream, vivid and surreal.
How could Will have had a daughter?
You look happy. Jake's father was leaning against his motorbike as I walked across the church hall's car park. I stopped in front of him.
It's a grief counselling session. I'm hardly going to come out tap dancing.
Fair point.
It's not what you think. I mean, it's not me, I said. It's to do with a teenager. He tipped his head backwards, spying Jake behind me.
Oh, right. Well, you have my sympathies there.
You look young to have a teenager, if you don't mind me saying.
Oh, no, no, not mine.
It's complicated.
I'd love to give you advice, but I don't have a clue.
He stepped forward and enveloped Jake in a hug, which the boy tolerated glumly.
You're right, young man.
Fine.
Fine, Sam said, glancing sideways at me. There you go. Universal response of all teenagers to everything. War, famine, lottery wins, global fame. It's all fine.
You didn't need to pick me up. I'm going to Jules.
Do you want a lift?
She lives like there, in that block, Jake pointed. I think I can manage that by myself.
Sam's expression remained even.
So maybe text me next time, save me coming here and waiting?
Jake shrugged and walked off, his rucksack slung over his shoulder. We watched him go in silence.
I'll see you later, yes, Jake?
Jake lifted a hand without looking back.
Okay, I said. So now I feel a tiny bit better.
Sam gave the slightest shake of his head. He watched his son go as if even now he couldn't bear to just leave him. Some days he feels it harder than others. And then he turned to me.
You want to grab a coffee or something, Louisa?
Just so I don't have to feel like the world's biggest loser.
It is Louisa, right?
I thought of what Jake had said in that evening session. On Friday, Dad brought home this psycho blonde called Mags, who was obsessed with him. When he was in the shower, she kept asking me if he talked about her when she wasn't there. The compulsive shagger. But he was nice enough. And he had helped put me back together in the ambulance. And the alternative was another night at home wondering what had been going on in Lily Horton Miller's head. If we can talk about anything but teenagers.
Can we talk about your outfit?
I looked down at my green lurex skirt and my Irish dancing shoes.
Absolutely not.
It was worth a try, he said, and climbed onto his motorbike. We sat outside a near empty bar a short distance from my flat. He drank black coffee and I had fruit juice. I had time to study him surreptitiously now that I wasn't dodging cars in a car park or lying strapped to a hospital gurney. His nose held a telltale ridge, and his eyes crinkled in a way that suggested there was almost no human behaviour he hadn't seen, and perhaps been slightly amused by. He was tall and broad, his feature coarser than Will's somehow, yet he moved with a kind of gentle economy, as if he had absorbed the effort of not damaging things just from his size. He was evidently more comfortable with listening than talking, or perhaps it was just that it was unsettling to be on my own with a man after so much time because I found I was gabbling. I talked about my job at the bar, making him laugh about Richard Percival and the horrors of my outfit, and how strange it had been to live briefly at home again, and my father's bad jokes, and Grandad and his donuts, and my nephew's unorthodox use of a blue marker pen. But I was conscious as I spoke, as so often these days, of how much I didn't say about Will. About the surreal thing that had happened to me the previous evening. About me. With Will, I had never had to consider what I said. Talking to him was as effortless as breathing. Now I was good at not really saying anything about myself at all. He just sat and nodded, watched the traffic go by and sipped his coffee, as if it were perfectly normal for him to be passing the time with a feverishly chatting stranger in a green lurex miniskirt. "So how's the hip?" he asked, when finally I ground to a halt.
"Not bad. I'd quite like to stop limping, though."
"Yeah, you'll get there, if you keep up with the physio."
For a moment, I could hear that voice from the back of the ambulance. Calm, unfazed, reassuring.
"The other injuries?"
I peered down at myself as if I could see through what I was wearing. Well, other than the fact that I look like someone's drawn all over bits of me with a particularly vivid red pen, not bad. Sam nodded.
"You were lucky. That was quite a fall."
And there it was again. The sick lurch in my stomach, the air beneath my feet.
You never know what will happen when you fall from a great height.
"I wasn't trying to,"
you said. But I'm not sure anyone believes me.
We exchanged an awkward smile, and for a minute I wondered if he didn't either.
"So, do you pick up many people who fall off the tops of buildings?"
He shook his head, gazed out across the road.
"I just pick up the pieces. I'm glad that in your case the pieces fitted back together."
We sat in silence for a while longer.
I kept thinking about the things I should say. But I was so out of practice at being alone with a man, while sober at least, that I kept losing my nerve, my mouth opening and closing like that of a goldfish. "So you want to tell me about the teenager?" Sam said. It was a relief to explain it to someone. I told him about the late-night knock at the door and our bizarre meeting and what I'd found on Facebook, and the way that she had run away before I'd had a chance to work out what on earth to do.
"Whoa," he said when I'd finished.
He gave a little shake of his head.
"You think she is who she says she is?"
"Well, she does look a bit like him, but I don't honestly know. Am I looking for signs? Am I seeing what I want to see? It's possible." I spend half my time thinking how amazing that there's something of him left behind, and the other half wondering if I'm being a complete sucker. And then there's this whole extra layer of stuff in the middle, like, if this is his daughter, then how is it fair that he never even got to meet her? And how are his parents supposed to cope with this? And what if meeting her would actually have changed his mind? What if that would have been the thing that convinced him? My voice tailed away. Sam leaned back in his chair, his brow furrowed.
"And this man would be the reason you're attending the group?"
"Yes." I could feel him studying me, perhaps reassessing what Will had meant to me. "I don't know what to do," I said. "I don't know whether to seek her out or whether I should just leave well enough alone." He looked out at the city street, thinking, and then he said,
"Well, what would he have done?"
And just like that, I faltered. I gazed up at that big man with his direct gaze, his two-day stubble and his kind, capable hands, and all my thoughts evaporated.
"You okay?"
I took a deep gulp of my drink, trying to hide what I felt was clearly written on my face. Suddenly, for no reason I could work out, I wanted to cry. It was too much. That odd, unbalancing night. The fact that Will had loomed up again, ever present in every conversation. I could see his face suddenly, that sardonic eyebrow raised as if to say, "What on earth are you up to now, Clark?" "Just a long day. Actually, would you mind if I..." Sam pushed his chair back, stood up.
No, you go. Sorry, I didn't think."
"This has been really nice. It's just..."
"No problem. Long day. And the whole grief thing, I get it."
No, don't worry," he said as I reached for my purse.
"Really, I can stand you an orange juice."
I think I might have run to my car in spite of my limp. I felt his eyes on me the whole way. I pulled up in the car park and let out a breath I felt as if I'd been holding all the way from the bar. I glanced over at the corner shop, then back at my flat and decided I didn't want to be sensible. I wanted wine, several large glasses of it, until I could persuade myself to stop looking backwards. Or maybe not look at anything at all. My hip ached as I climbed out of the car. Since Richard had arrived, it hurt constantly. The physio at the hospital had told me not to spend too much time on my feet, but the thought of saying as much to Richard filled me with dread.
"I see. So you work in a bar, but you want to be allowed to sit down all day. Is that it?"
That milk-fed, preparing-for-middle-management face, that carefully nondescript haircut, the air of weary superiority, even though he was barely 2 years older than me. I closed my eyes and tried to make the knot of anxiety in my stomach disappear. "Just this, please," I said, placing a bottle of cold Sauvignon Blanc on the counter.
"Party, is it?"
"What?"
"Fancy dress. You're going, is..." "No, don't tell me."
Samir stroked his chin.
"Snow White."
"Sure," I said.
"You want to be careful with that.
Empty calories, innit? You want to drink vodka. That's a clean drink. Maybe a bit of lemon. That's what I tell Ginny across the road. You know she's a lap dancer, right? They've got to watch their figures."
"Dietary advice. Nice.
It's like all this stuff about sugar, yeah? You got to watch the sugar. No point buying the low-fat stuff. It's full of sugar, right? There's your empty calories, right there. And them chemical sugars are the worst. They stick to your gut."
He rang up the wine, handed me my change. "What's that you're eating, Samir?"
"Smoky bacon pot noodle. Oh, it's good, man."
I was lost in thought. Somewhere in the dark crevasse between my sore pelvis, existential job-related despair, and a weird craving for smoky bacon pot noodle, when I saw her. She was in the doorway of my block, sitting on the ground, her arms wrapped around her knees. I took my change from Samir and half walked, half ran across the road. "Lily?" She looked up slowly. Her voice was slurred, her eyes bloodshot as if she'd been crying.
"Nobody would let me in. I rang all the bells, but nobody would let me in."
I wrestled the key into the door and propped it with my bag, crouching down beside her. What happened?
Oh, I just want to go to sleep, she said, rubbing her eyes. I'm so, so tired. I wanted to get a taxi home, but I haven't got any money.
I caught the sour whiff of alcohol. Are you drunk?
I don't know.
She blinked at me, tilting her head. I wondered then if it was just alcohol.
If I'm not, you've totally turned into a leprechaun.
She patted her pockets.
Oh, look, look what I've got.
She held up a half-smoked roll-up that even I could smell was not just tobacco.
Let's have a smoke, Lily, she said.
Oh, no, wait, you're Louisa, I'm Lily. She giggled, and pulling a lighter clumsily from her pocket, promptly tried to light the wrong end.
Okay, you, time to go home.
I took it from her hand and, ignoring her vague protest, squashed it firmly under my foot. I'll call you a taxi.
I don't...
Lily! I glanced up. A young man stood across the street, his hands in his jean pockets, watching us steadily. Lily looked up at him and then away. Who's that? I said. She stared at her feet.
Lily,
come here. His voice held the surety of possession. He stood, legs slightly apart, as if even at that distance he expected her to obey him. Something made me instantly uneasy.
Nobody moved.
Is he your boyfriend? Do you want to talk to him? I said quietly. The first time she spoke, I couldn't make out what she said. I had to lean closer and ask her to repeat herself. Make him go away. She closed her eyes and turned her face towards the door. Please. He began to walk across the street towards us. I stood and tried to make my voice sound as authoritative as possible.
You can go now, thanks. Lily's coming inside with me.
He stopped halfway across the road. I held his gaze.
You can speak to her some other time, okay?
I had my hand on the buzzer and now muttered at some imaginary, muscular, short-tempered boyfriend.
Yeah. Do you want to come down and give me a hand, Dave?
Thanks. The young man's expression suggested this was not the last of it. Then he turned, pulled his phone from his pocket and began a low, urgent conversation with someone as he walked away, ignoring the beeping taxi that had to swerve around him and casting us only the briefest of backwards looks. I sighed, a little more shakily than I'd expected, put my hands under her armpits and with not very much elegance and a fair amount of muffled swearing, managed to haul Lily Horton Miller into the lobby. That night she slept at my flat. I couldn't think what else to do with her. She was sick twice in the bathroom, batting me away when I tried to hold her hair up for her. She refused to give me a home phone number, or maybe couldn't remember it, and her mobile phone was pin-locked. I cleaned her up, helped her into a pair of my jogging bottoms and a T-shirt, and led her into the living room.
You tidied up,
she said, with a little exclamation, as if I had done it just for her. I made her drink a glass of water and put her on the sofa in the recovery position, even though I was pretty sure by then there was nothing left inside her to come out. As I lifted her head and placed her on the pillow, she opened her eyes as if recognizing me properly for the first time. Sorry. She spoke so quietly that for a moment I couldn't be entirely sure that that was what she had said, and her eyes brimmed briefly with tears. I covered her with a blanket and watched her as she fell asleep. Her pale face, the blue shadows under her eyes, the eyebrows that followed the same curve that Will's had, the same faint sprinkling of freckles. Almost as an afterthought, I locked the flat door and brought the keys into my bedroom with me, tucking them under my pillow, to stop her stealing anything or simply to stop her leaving. I wasn't sure. I lay awake, my mind still busy with the sound of the sirens in the airport and the faces of the grieving in the church hall and the hard, knowing stare of the young man across the road, and the knowledge that I had someone who was essentially a stranger sleeping under my roof. And all the while a voice kept saying, "What on earth are you doing?" But what else could I have done? Finally, some time after the birds started singing, and the bakery van unloaded its morning delivery downstairs, my thoughts slowed and stilled, and I fell asleep. Chapter 7 I could smell coffee. It took me several seconds to consider why the smell of coffee might be filtering through my flat, and when the answer registered, I sat bolt upright and leaped out of bed, hauling my hoodie over my head. She was cross-legged on the sofa, smoking, using my one good mug as an ashtray. The television was on, some manic children's confection of brightly clad, gurning presenters, and two styrofoam cups sat on the mantelpiece.
Oh, hi, that one on the right's yours, she said, turning briefly towards me. I didn't know what you liked, so I got you an Americano. I blinked, wrinkling my nose against the cigarette smoke. I crossed the room and opened a window. I looked at the clock. Is that the time?
Yeah.
The coffee might be a bit cold. Didn't know whether to wake you.
It's my day off, I said, reaching for the coffee. It was warm enough. I took a slug gratefully. Then I stared at the cup.
Hang on. How did you get these? I locked the front door.
I went down the fire escape, she said. I didn't have any money, so I told the guy at the bakery whose flat it was, and he said that you could bring it in later.
Oh, and you also owe him for 2 bagels with smoked salmon and cream cheese.
I do?
I wanted to be cross, but I was suddenly really hungry. She followed my gaze.
Oh, I ate those.
She blew a smoke ring into the centre of the room. You didn't have anything much in your fridge. You really do need to sort this place out. The Lily of this morning was such a different character from the girl I had picked off the street last night that it was hard to believe they were the same person. I walked back into the bedroom to get dressed, listening to her watching television, padding into the kitchen to fetch herself a drink.
Hey, thingy, Louise, could you lend me some money? She called out.
If it's to get off your face again, no. She walked into my bedroom without knocking. I pulled my sweatshirt up to my chest.
Can I stay tonight?
I need to talk to your mum, Lily.
What for?
I need to know a little bit more about what's actually going on here. She stood in the doorway.
So you don't believe me?
I gestured to her to turn around so I could finish putting my bra on.
I do believe you. But that's the deal. You want something from me? I need to know a bit more about you first.
Just as I pulled my t-shirt over my head, she turned back again.
Seat yourself. I need to pick up some more clothes anyway.
Why? Where have you been staying? She walked away from me as if she hadn't heard, sniffing her armpit.
Can I use your shower? I absolutely reek.
An hour later, we drove to St. John's Wood. I was exhausted, both by the night's events and the strange energy Lily gave off beside me. She fidgeted constantly, smoked endless cigarettes, then sat in silence so loaded I could almost feel the weight of her thoughts. So who was he, that guy from last night? I kept my face to the front, my voice neutral.
Just someone.
You told me he was your boyfriend.
Then that's who he was.
Her voice had hardened, her face closed. As we drew nearer to her parents' house, she crossed her arms in front of her, bringing her knees up to her chin, her gaze set and defiant, as if already in silent battle. I had wondered if she'd been telling me the truth about St. John's Wood, but she gestured to a wide tree-lined street and told me to take the third left, and we were in the kind of road where diplomats or expat American bankers live. The kind of road that nobody ever seems to go in or come out of. I pulled the car up, gazing out of the window at the tall white stucco buildings, the carefully trimmed yew hedging and immaculate window boxes.
You live here?
She slammed the passenger door behind us so hard that my little car rattled.
I don't live here. They live here.
She let herself in and I followed awkwardly, feeling like an intruder. We were in a spacious, high-ceilinged hallway with parquet flooring and a huge gilt mirror on the wall, a slew of white card invitations jostling for space in its frame. A vase of beautifully arranged flowers sat on a small antique table. The air was scented with their perfume. From upstairs came the sound of commotion, possibly children's voices, it was hard to tell.
My half-brothers, Lily said dismissively, and walked through to the kitchen, apparently expecting me to follow.
It was enormous, in modernist grey with an endless mushroom-coloured polished concrete worktop. Everything in it screamed money. From the jewel-lit toaster to the coffee maker, which was large and complicated enough not to be out of place in a Milanese cafe. Lily opened the fridge and scanned it, finally pulling out a box of fresh pineapple pieces that she started to eat with her fingers.
Lily?
A voice from upstairs, urgent, female.
Lily, is that you?
The sound of footsteps racing down. Lily rolled her eyes. A blonde woman appeared in the doorway. She stared at me, then at Lily, who was dropping a piece of pineapple languidly into her mouth. She walked over and snatched the container from her hands.
Where the hell have you been? The school is beside themselves. Daddy was out driving round the neighbourhood. We thought you'd been murdered. Where were you?
He's not my dad.
Don't you get smart with me, young lady. You can't just walk back in here like nothing's happened. Do you have any idea of the trouble you've caused? I was up with your brother half the night and then I couldn't sleep for worrying about what had happened to you. I've had to cancel our trip to Granny Horton's house because we didn't know where you were.
Lily stared at her coolly.
I don't know why you bothered. You don't usually care where I am.
The woman stiffened with rage. She was thin, the kind of thin that comes with faddy diets or compulsive exercise. Her hair was expensively cut and coloured so it looked neither, and she was wearing what I assumed were designer jeans. But her face, tanned as it was, betrayed her. She looked exhausted. She spun round to me.
Is it you she's been staying with?
Well, yes, but she looked me up and down and apparently decided she was not enamoured of what she saw.
Do you know the trouble you're causing? Do you have any idea how old she is? What the hell do you want with a girl that young anyway? You must be, what, 30?
Actually, I...
Is this what it's about? She asked her daughter. Are you having a relationship with this woman? Oh, Mum, shut up!
Lily had picked up the pineapple again and was fishing around in it with her forefinger. It's not what you think. She hasn't caused any of it. She lowered the last piece of pineapple into her mouth, pausing to chew, perhaps for dramatic effect, before she spoke again. She's the woman who used to look after my dad. My real dad. Tanya Horton Miller sat back in the endless cushions of her cream sofa and stirred her coffee. I perched on the edge of the sofa opposite, gazing at the oversized diptyque candles and the artfully placed interiors magazines. I was slightly afraid that if I sat back as she had, my coffee would tip into my lap. "How did you meet my daughter?" she said wearily. Her wedding finger sported two of the biggest diamonds I'd ever seen. "I didn't, really. She turned up at my flat. I had no idea who she was." She digested that for a minute. "And you used to look after Will Traynor?"
"Yes, until he died."
There was a brief pause as we both studied the ceiling. Something had just crashed above our heads. "My sons," she sighed, "they have some behavioural issues." "Are they from your..."
"No, they're not Will's, if that's what you're asking."
We sat there in silence, or as near to silence as it could get when you could hear furious screaming upstairs. There was another thud, followed by an ominous silence. "Mrs. Horton Miller," I said, "is it true? Is Lily Will's daughter?" She raised her chin slightly.
"Yes."
I felt suddenly shaky and put my coffee cup on the table. "I don't understand. I don't understand how..."
"It's quite simple. Will and I were together during the last year of uni. I was totally in love with him, of course. Everyone was. Although I should say it wasn't all one-way traffic, you know?"
She raised a small smile and waited, as if expecting me to say something. I couldn't. How could Will not have told me he had a daughter? After everything we'd been through... Tanya drawled on.
"Anyway, we were the golden couple of our group. Balls, punting, weekends away, you know the drill. Will and I were... well, we were everywhere."
She told the story as if it was still fresh to her, as if it was something she had gone over and over in her head. "And then at our founder's ball, I had to leave to help my friend Lisa, who had got herself into a bit of a mess, and when I came back, Will was gone. No idea where he was. So I waited there for ages, and all the cars came and took everyone home, and finally a girl I didn't even know very well came up to me and told me that Will had gone home with a girl called Stephanie Loudon. You won't know her, but she'd had her eye on him forever. Well, at first I didn't believe it, and I drove to her house anyway and sat outside, and sure enough, at 5 a.m, he came out and they stood there kissing on the doorstep like they couldn't care who saw. And when I got out of the car and confronted him, he didn't even have the grace to be ashamed. He just said there was no point in us getting emotional, as we were never going to last beyond college anyway. And then, of course, college finished, which was something of a relief, to be honest, because who wants to be the girl Will Traynor dumped? But it was so hard to get over, because it had ended so abruptly. After we left and he started work in the city, I wrote to him asking if we could at least meet for a drink so I could work out what on earth had gone wrong. Because as far as I was concerned, we had been really happy, you know? And he just got his secretary to send this card, saying that she was very sorry, but Will's diary was absolutely full, and he didn't have time right now, but he wished me all the best. All the best!" She grimaced. I winced internally. Much as I wanted to discount her story, this version of Will held a horrible ring of truth. Will himself had looked back at his earlier life with utter clarity, had confessed how badly he had treated women when he was younger. His exact words were, "I was a complete arse." Tanya was still talking.
"And then about 2 months later, I discovered I was pregnant. And it was already awfully late because my periods had always been erratic and I hadn't realised I'd already missed two. So I decided to go ahead and have Lily, but..."
Here she lifted her chin again, as if braced to defend herself.
"Well, there was no point in telling him. Not after everything he'd said and done."
My coffee had gone cold. No point in telling him.
Well, he'd as good as said he didn't want anything to do with me. He would have acted as if I'd done it deliberately to trap him or something.
My mouth was hanging open. I closed it. But you don't think he had the right to know, Mrs. Horton Miller? You don't think he might have wanted to meet his child, regardless of what had happened between the two of you? She put down her cup.
But she's 16, I said. She would have been 14, 15 when he died. That's an awful long... Well, by that time she had Francis. He was her father. And he has been very good to her. We were a family. Well, we are a family.
I don't understand.
Will didn't deserve to know her.
The words settled in the air between us.
He was an arsehole, okay? Will Traynor was a selfish arsehole.
She pushed a strand of hair back from her face.
Obviously I didn't know what had happened to him. That came as a complete shock. But I can't honestly say it would have made a difference.
It took me a moment to find my voice. It would have made every difference to him. She looked at me sharply. Will killed himself, I said, and my voice cracked a little. Will ended his life because he couldn't see any reason to go on for. If he'd have known he had a daughter, she stood up.
Oh, no, you don't pin that on me, miss, whoever you are. I'm not going to be made to feel responsible for that man's suicide. You think my life isn't complicated enough? Don't you dare come here judging me. If you'd had to cope with half of what I cope with... No, Will Traynor was a horrible man. Will Traynor was the finest man I ever knew.
She let her gaze run up and down me.
Yes, well, I can imagine that's probably true.
I thought I had never been filled with such an instant dislike for someone. I had stood to leave when a voice broke into the silence. So my dad... really didn't know about me. Lily was standing very still in the doorway. Tanya Horton Miller blanched, then she recovered herself.
I was saving you from hurt, Lily. I knew Will very well, and I was not prepared to put either of us through the humiliation of trying to persuade him to be part of a relationship he wouldn't have wanted.
She smoothed her hair.
And you really must stop this awful eavesdropping habit. You're likely to get quite the wrong end of the stick.
I couldn't listen to any more. I walked to the door as a boy began shouting upstairs. A plastic truck flew down the stairs and crashed into pieces somewhere below. An anxious face, Filipina, gazed at me over the banister. I began to walk down the stairs.
Where are you going?
I'm sorry, Lily. Perhaps we'll talk some other time.
But you've hardly told me anything about my dad. He wasn't your father, Tanya Horton Miller said. Francis has done more for you since you were little than Will ever would have done. Francis is not my dad, Lily roared. Another crash from upstairs and a woman's voice shouting in a language I didn't understand.
A toy machine gun sent tiny blasts into the air. Tanya put her hands up to her head.
I can't cope with this. I simply can't cope.
Lily caught up with me at the door. Can I stay with you?
What? At your flat. I can't stay here.
Lily, I don't think...
Just for tonight, please. Oh, be my guest. Have her stay with you for a day or two. She's just delightful company.
Tanya waved a hand.
Polite, helpful, loving. A dream to have around.
Her face hardened.
Let's see how that works out.
You know she drinks and smokes in the house.
And that she was suspended from school. She's told you all of this, has she?
Lily seemed almost bored, as if she had heard this a million times before.
She didn't even bother turning up for her exams. We've done everything possible for her. Counsellors, the best schools, private tutors. Francis has treated her as if she were his own. And she just throws it all back in our faces. My husband is having a very difficult time at the bank right now, and the boys have their issues, and she doesn't give us an inch. She never has. How would you even know? I've been with nannies half my life, and when the boys were born, you sent me to boarding school. I couldn't cope with all of you. I did what I could. You did what you wanted, which was to start your perfect family all over again without me.
Lily turned her back to me.
Please, just for a bit, I promise I won't get under your feet at all, and I'll be really helpful.
I should have said no.